if you believe assault is an act, not an adjective, your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. What do you believe? Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. Welcome. This is your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio. Back in the... a little bit off. We had a little bit of trouble with the ISDN line earlier. We'll try to get that thing fixed up. So anyhow, we're coming to you on Skype. But back home at the at the main studio back here in Nevada. Last week was a fun week, I got to tell you. We go down to San Diego, get an invite from Ed and Paula, my best friend Ed and his lovely wife Paula, go down to San Diego right there in Imperial Beach, and just had a wonderful vacation. I spent the first 2 days working, trying to get all kinds of stuff caught up. The first 2 days at the laptop, getting stuff done. I was able to look at the beach, and a couple of times I actually got my feet wet for a moment or two while my girlfriend's out there with the kids, and they're, out there splish-splashing, having fun, having a great time, walking up the beach to go to the little seashell shops and everything. It was a lot of fun. They really had a good time. And then it's kind of weird. I don't really get it. I don't know if it's a Southern California thing or what, but last year when we were down there, it was August, and when we were there, my girlfriend got strep throat. We had to go to the doctor, get her some prescriptions, and get her fixed up. We're down there this year, and one of my daughters ends up getting strep throat. So we get all this identified and get more prescriptions. And then what happens last night? I go to check on my youngest to see how my youngest is doing, and my youngest is now showing signs of strep throat. So, my goodness, I gotta tell you, it is one thing after another. And then, we boarded the dog at a place here in Pahrump, which is a great place, excellent place called Animal House. A fellow by the name of John, he and his wife own it. Really wonderful people. You board your dog for a few days and they start to smell like a kennel. But they will, it's like $20 or something. They'll wash the dog, trim them, get them all cleaned up and everything. So we did that. Went and picked up the dog yesterday morning, brought her home, and now she's got some problem with her left eye. She doesn't want to open her eye. This poor dog, right? We rescued this dog probably about 14 months ago from what's kind of an old dog rescue. She'd been there for 2 years. She's probably about 5 or 6 years old now. Absolutely the sweetest dog, probably the sweetest dog I've ever owned. Just an absolutely wonderful dog. I have never in my life been a fan of pit bulls. My girlfriend is a huge fan of pit bulls. Our dog is a pit. And all the stereotypes I had ever thought of when it comes to pits are totally blown away with this dog. She is absolutely sweet as can be. And she doesn't have the use of her left rear leg. She hops around on the other three. She's had a bit of a hard life. And then when she comes back and then... now she's got a problem with her eye. I've got a couple of kids with strep. It's so overwhelming. Just so overwhelming. But today, we should have some good news coming out. I'm going to talk about that when we come back from the break. So stay tuned. We'll be back after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're listening right here to 2A Radio. Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes is live. 1-800-313-9443. Hi, guys. Welcome back. We have fixed the issue. We're back on the ISDN line. I guess it's something to do with the bitrate. Anyhow, everything is all good. Today, we expect some very big news out of the Supreme Court. Today is the day that the McDonald versus Chicago decision comes out. Now, some of you don't know how the whole court works. The court works on, quite obviously, their own schedule. The Supreme Court does not listen to every case that comes in front of them. Every case that is put in front of them, you know, they can pick and choose which cases they want to hear. Usually they'll look at something based on its constitutional basis. As a matter of fact, as I read, I just typed it in, and McDonald v. Chicago has just now, right now, live on the air, been published. So I guess we're going to spend a good portion of the rest of the show going through this. It has just right now been put up on SupremeCourt.gov. McDonald versus City of Chicago. I'm reading this live right here on the air. Let's see. 2 years ago in D.C. versus Heller, this court held that the Second Amendment protects the right to keep and bear arms for the purpose of self-defense and struck down a District of Columbia law that banned the possession of handguns in the home. Chicago, hereinafter city, and the village of Oak Park, a Chicago suburb, have laws effectively banning handgun possessions by almost all private citizens. After Heller, petitioners filed this federal suit against the city, which was consolidated with two related, actions, alleging that the city's handgun ban has left them vulnerable to criminals. They sought a declaration that the ban and several, related city ordinances violated the Second and 14th Amendments, rejecting petitioners' arguments that the ordinance are unconstitutional. The court noted that the Seventh Circuit previously had upheld the constitutionality of a handgun ban, that Heller had explicitly refrained from opening on whether the Second Amendment applied to the states, and the court had a duty to follow established court procedures. The Seventh Circuit affirmed, relying on the 19th century case United States versus Chickasaw, that's named, who cares, and Miller versus Texas, which were decided in the wake of this court's interpretation of the 14th Amendment Privileges or Immunities Clause in the Slaughterhouse case. The judgment is reversed and the case is remanded, which we will get to in just a moment. McDonald v. Chicago, the 10th Amendment incorporates the Second Amendment right. I'm sorry. I need to go back. These pages have such a big page. Concluding that the 14th Amendment incorporates the Second Amendment right recognized in Heller to keep and bear arms for the purpose of self-defense. Folks, we won. From my mouth to your ears through God's eyes, we won, McDonald. Petitioners based their case on two submissions. Primarily, they argued that the right to keep and bear arms is protected by the Privileges or Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, and that the Slaughterhouse case's narrow interpretation of the clause should now be rejected. That's 140 years, folks, of standing case law at the Supreme Court in the Slaughterhouse case. 140 years of standing case law has now been overturned. As a secondary argument, they contend that the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause incorporates the Second Amendment right. Chicago and Oak Park municipal residents maintain that the right set out in the Bill of Rights applies to the states only when it is indispensable, an indispensable attribute of any civilized legal system. If it is possible to imagine a civilized country that does not recognize the right, municipal respondents assert that the right is not protected by due process. And since there are civilized countries that ban or strictly regulate the private possession of handguns, they maintain that due process does not preclude such measures. The Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment, originally applied only to the federal government, not to the states. Let's see. But the constitutional amendment adopted in the Civil War's aftermath fundamentally altered the federal system. 4 years after the adoption of the 14th Amendment, this court held that the Slaughterhouse case, that the Privileges or Immunities Clause protects only those rights which owe their existence to the federal government, its national charter, and its constitution or its laws. Let's see. Under this narrow reading, the court held that the Privileges or Immunities Clause protects only very limited rights, because they created a whole new class of citizens they weren't happy about. Let's see, the decisions on which the Seventh Circuit relied on the case. All right, so whether the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms applies to the states is considered in light of the court's precedent applying the Bill of Rights protections to the states. In the late 19th century, the court began to hold that the Due Process Clause prohibits the states from infringing Bill of Rights protections. Five features of the approach were taken during the ensuing era and noted. Let's see. First, the court reviewed the due process questions entirely separate from the questions whether the right of privileges, immunities, and blah, da, 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 da. Gosh, why can't they just give us a simple decision? Guys, for those of you just tuning in, the Chicago v. McDonald case was just announced, and I am reading it live on the air. You are probably the very first people in the entire country to hear the adjudication. And quite honestly, what it comes down to is, we won. The Chicago handgun case is being, the Chicago gun ban is being flushed. They cannot have it. It has been ruled unconstitutional. Let's see, we're going through all kinds of history. I'm trying to breeze through that. Be rooted in national history, tradition. Okay, so they give all kinds of history and tradition here. This is a huge document. I'm trying to scroll through this and actually come beyond the syllabus to the actual ruling. Let's see. Opinion of the court. Supreme Court of the United States. Otis McDonald et al. Petitioners versus City of Chicago. Justice Alito is the one who wrote this. Announced the judgment of the court and delivered the opinion of the court with respect to all of the various parts, which the Chief Justice, Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, and Justice Thomas join in an opinion with respect to all of these. The Chief Justice, Justice Scalia, and Justice Kennedy join. 2 years ago in the District of Columbia v. Heller, we held that the Second Amendment protects the right to keep and bear arms for the purpose of self-defense, and we struck down a District of Columbia law that banned the possession of handguns in the home. The City of Chicago, known as the City, and the Village of Oak Park, a Chicago suburb, have laws that are similar to the District of Columbia's, but Chicago and Oak Park argue that their laws are constitutional because the Second Amendment has no application to the states. We have previously held that most of the provisions of the Bill of Rights apply with full force to both the federal government and to the states. Applying the standard that is well established in our case law, we hold that the Second Amendment right is fully applicable to the states. Right there, we won. That's all we need to know. Otis McDonald, Adam Orloff, Colleen Lawson, and David Lawson, Chicago petitioners, are Chicago residents who would like to keep handguns in their home for self-defense, but are prohibited from doing so by Chicago's firearms laws. A city ordinance provides that no person shall possess any firearms unless such person is the holder of a valid registration certificate for such firearm. Chicago, Illinois Municipal Code says that. The code then prohibits registration of most handguns, thus effectively banning handgun possession by most all private citizens who reside in the city. Like Chicago, Oak Park makes it unlawful for any person to possess any firearm, a term that includes pistols, revolvers, guns, and small arms, commonly known as handguns. Chicago enacted its handgun ban to protect its residents, quote, from the loss of property and injury or death from firearms, end quote. Let's see. The Chicago petitioners and their amici, however, argued that the handgun ban has left them vulnerable to criminals. Chicago Police Department statistics, we are told, revealed that the city's handgun murder rate has actually increased since the ban was enacted. Imagine that. And that Chicago residents now face one of the highest murder rates in the country and the rates of other violent crimes that exceed the average in comparison cities. Matter of fact, it far exceeds. I happen to have those numbers. Several of the Chicago petitioners have been targets of threats and violence. For instance, Otis McDonald, who is in his late 70s, lives in a high-crime neighborhood. He is a community activist involved with alternative policing strategies, and his efforts to improve his neighborhood have subjected him to violent threats from drug dealers. Let's see here. Colleen Lawson is a Chicago resident whose home has been targeted by burglars. And Ms. Lawson's judgment, possessing a handgun in Chicago would decrease her chances of suffering serious injury or death should she ever be threatened again in her home. McDonald Lawson and other Chicago petitioners, own handguns and they are stored outside the city limits, but they would like to keep their handguns in their homes for protection. After our decision in Heller, the Chicago petitioners and two groups filed suit against the City of the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois. They sought a declaration that the handgun ban and several related Chicago ordinance violated the 2nd and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution. Another action challenged the Oak Park lawsuit, which is filed in the same district court by the National Rifle Association and two Oak Park residents. In addition, the NRA and others filed third actions challenging the Chicago ban. Awesome. Guys, stay tuned. We're going to cover this more after the break. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're listening to it live, the decision in Chicago from the McDonald v. Chicago case right here on 2A Radio.
I've been roaming around, always looking down at all I see.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
Hey guys, you can imagine that I am absolutely blowing up here. My phone calls, I was just on the phone. I've secured a publicist dealing with this particular case to try to be able to comment. CNN has just announced that it's there. They read the first few pages. You are the first people in the entire country to actually hear the actual words of the decision. Chicago, we're reading the McDonald v. Chicago case right here live on 2A Radio. Chicago and Oak Park municipal respondents maintain that a right set out in the Bill of Rights applies to the states only if that right is an indispensable attribute of any civilized legal system, as they claim. The brief for the municipal respondents says it is possible to imagine a civilized country that does not recognize the right, the municipal respondents tell us then that the right is not protected by due process. So what they're trying to say is, other countries ban guns, so we should be able to ban guns because we consider Europe to be a civilized society, is essentially the argument. See, and since there are civilized countries that ban or strictly regulate the private possession of handguns, the municipal respondents maintain that due process does not preclude such measures, such as their handgun ban. In light of the party's far-reaching arguments, we begin to recount this court's analysis over the years of the relationship between the provisions of the Bill of Rights and the states. So they kept it here at home, going by the Constitution. The Bill of Rights, including the Second Amendment, originally applied only to the federal government. In the court in an opinion by Chief Justice Marshall explained that the question was, quote, of great importance, but not of much difficulty. In less than four pages, the court firmly rejected the proposition that the first eight amendments operate as limitations on the states, holding that they apply only to the federal government. It is now settled that these amendments in the Bill of Rights do not extend to the states, was what they think. The constitutional amendments adopted in aftermath of the Civil War fundamentally altered this country's federal system. The provisions at issue in this case of the 14th Amendment provides, among other things, that the states may not abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, and that's a 14th Amendment citizen because it's lowercase, or deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So again, the due process clause, because rather than an alienable rights. We talked about this on the show last week, okay? 4 years after the adoption of the 14th Amendment, this court was asked to interpret the amendments reference to the privileges or immunities of citizens, lowercase c, of the United States, basically the newly freed slaves. The Slaughterhouse case involves challenges to the Louisiana law permitting the creation of state-sanctioned monopoly on the butchering of animals within the city of New Orleans. Justice Samuel Miller's opinion for the court concluded that privileges or immunities clause protects only those rights which owe their existence to the federal government, its national charter, its constitution, or its laws. The court held that the fundamental rights, rights that predated the creation of the federal government and the state's government were created to establish and secure, were not protected by the clause. Meaning that, in fact, they did have a second class of citizens created by the 14th Amendment that did not enjoy the same sort of inalienable rights as the original class of citizens. And keep in mind, the federal government for many years now has been trying to, through their paperwork and everything that they do, incorporate everyone in the country under the 14th Amendment class of citizenry and essentially eliminate the original class because the government has way more power. In drawing a sharp distinction between the rights of federal and state citizenship, the court relied on two principal arguments. First, the court emphasized that the 14th Amendment Privileges or Immunities Clause spoke of the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. And the court contrasted the phrasing with the wording of the first sentence of the 14th Amendment in the Privileges and Immunities Clause, Article 4, both of which state the state, refer to the state citizenship. Second, the court added the contrary rent, big deal. Okay, you know, I don't really want to hear too much about all the history. I want to know what we got in our hand right now. I want to know what bird is in the hand. I'm not concerned about the old bird in the bush. Let's see. We're going through lots of signing, opinion of the court. Let's see, in this case, the court reviewed convictions stemming from the infamous Colfax Massacre in Louisiana on Easter Sunday in 1873. Dozens of blacks, many unarmed, were slaughtered by a rival band of armed white men. Cookershank himself allegedly marched unarmed and African-American prisoners through the streets and then had them summarily executed. 97 men were indicted for participating in the massacre, but only 9 went to trial. 6 of the 9 were acquitted on all charges. The remaining 3 were acquitted of murder, but convicted under the Enforcement Act of 1870. Banning and conspiring together to deprive their victims of various constitutional rights, including the right to bear arms. So what we have is an incredibly ugly black mark. Just total black eye on society back in that time. The court reversed all of the convictions, including those relating to the deprivation of victims' rights to bear arms. This court wrote that the right to bearing arms for lawful purpose is not granted by the Constitution and is not in any manner dependent on the instrument. Anyhow, that was overturned. I'm going to review this more during the break. I'll try to get you the meat of the matter once we return. Stay tuned, guys. You're listening live to the McDonald v. Chicago decision right here on 2A Radio.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Gun control, loved by dictators since 1917. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443.
All right, guys, welcome back. You're listening live right here on 2A Radio, where we are the first ones in the country to actually be reading the decision out of the Supreme Court in the McDonald versus Chicago case. My BlackBerry's been absolutely blowing up in the last few minutes because we're sitting here reading this and it's coming down. It's a good thing. In short, we won. We're going through some of the specifics on the case. During the break, I was reading through the incorporation process where they selectively incorporate different portions of the Bill of Rights through the 14th Amendment class of citizens, which was created after the Civil War to offer freed slaves some form of citizenship, which was not the original class of citizenship. So, and that was part of the city of Chicago's argument as to why they could have a ban. Let's see. With this framework in mind, we now turn directly to the question whether the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms is incorporated in the concept of due process. In answering that question, as just explained, we must decide whether the right to keep and bear arms is fundamental to our scheme of ordered liberty, through the Duncan case, or as we have had in related contexts, whether this right is deeply rooted in this nation's history and traditions, as stated in Washington versus Glucksberg in 1997. Our decision in Heller points unmistakably to the answer. Self-defense is a basic right, recognized by many legal systems from ancient times to the present day. And in Heller, we held that individual self-defense is the central component of the Second Amendment right. Let's see. Explaining that the need for self-defense of self, family, and property is most acute in the home. We find that this right applies to handguns because they are the most preferred firearm in the nation to keep and use for protection of one's home and family. Getting past all of the mumbo jumbo, the American people have considered the handgun to be the quintessential self-defense weapon. Thus, we conclude citizens must be permitted to use handguns for the core lawful purpose of self-defense. Heller makes it clear that this right is deeply rooted in this nation's history and traditions. Heller explored the right's origins, noting that the 1689 English Bill of Rights explicitly protects a right to keep arms for self-defense, and that by 1765, Blackstone was able to assert that the right to keep and bear arms was, quote, one of the fundamental rights of Englishmen. Blackstone's assessment was shared by the American colonists. As we noted in Heller, King George III's attempt to disarm the colonists in the 1760s and 1770s provoked polemical reactions by Americans invoking their rights as Englishmen to keep arms. There's a whole lot of different court cases cited in here. I'm trying to get over that. Let's see, the right to keep and bear arms was considered no less fundamental by those who drafted and ratified the Bill of Rights during the 1788 ratification debates. I'm sorry, here's a quote. During the 1788 ratification debates, the fear that the federal government would disarm the people in order to impose rule through a standing army or select militia was pervasive as anti-federalist rhetoric, according to Heller. Lots of stuff being cited right here. Federalists respond not by arguing that the right was insufficiently important to warrant protection, but by contending that the right was adequately protected by the Constitution's assignment of only limited powers to the federal government. Thus, anti-federalists and federalists alike agreed that the right to bear arms was fundamental to the newly formed system of government. To keep and bear arms, the origins of an Anglo-American right, 1994. But those who were fearful of the new federal government would infringe traditional rights, such as the right to keep and bear arms, insisted on the adoption of the Bill of Rights as a condition for ratification of the Constitution. That's absolutely right. This is surely powerful evidence that the right was regarded as fundamental in the sense relevant here. So what the court did was they actually went back and interpreted the meaning of the Constitution at the time it was written by the men that wrote it in the era in which they created it, which is exactly the way you have to interpret the Constitution. That's the only way you can. Now, this understanding persisted in the years immediately following the ratification of the Bill of Rights. In addition to the four states that had adopted Second Amendment analogs before ratification, nine more states adopted state constitutional provisions protecting an individual right to keep and bear arms between 1789 and 1820. As a matter of fact, the state of Nevada, which was created just before that, has that same sort of clause. See, founding era legal commentators confirmed the importance of the right to early Americans. St. George Tucker, for example, described the right to keep and bear arms as the true Palladium of Liberty, and explained that prohibitions on the right to place liberty on the brink of destruction. By the 1850s, the perceived threat had prompted the inclusion of the Second Amendment in the Bill of Rights for the fear of the national government would disarm the universal militia, had largely faded as a popular concern, but the right to keep and bear arms was highly valued for purposes of self-defense. Abolitionist authors wrote in support of the right, a treaty on the... And when attempts were made to disarm free soldiers by bloody Kansans, Senator Charles Sumner, who later played a leading role in the adoption of the 14th Amendment, proclaimed that never was the rifle more needed in just self-defense than now in Kansas. The crime against Kansas, the analogies for the crime, the true remedy speech, blah, da, 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 da. Come on, give us... After the Civil War, many of the over 180,000 African Americans who served in the Union Army returned to the states of the old Confederacy, where systematic efforts were made to disarm them and other blacks. See, the laws of some states formally prohibited African Americans from possessing firearms. For example, a Mississippi law provided that no freed man, free Negro, or mulatto, not in the military service of the United States, United States government, and not licensed to do so by the Board of Police or of his or her county, shall keep or carry a firearm of any kind or any ammunition, dirk or Bowie knife, which meant that in this particular law in Mississippi provided that blacks could not protect themselves, period, at all, even if they were veterans of the war. Throughout the South, armed parties, often consisting of ex-Confederate soldiers serving in the state militias, forcibly took firearms from newly freed slaves. In the first session of the 39th Congress, Senator Wilson told his colleagues, in Mississippi, rebel state forces, men who were in the rebel armies and traversing the state, visiting the freedmen, disarming them, perpetrating murders and outrages upon them, and the same things are done in other sections of this country. The report of the Joint Committee on Reconstruction, which is widely reprinted in the press and distributed by members of the 39th Conference, our Congress to the Constituent, blah, 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 blah. What this is really doing is it's going through the history of the city of Chicago's attempt to say that through the 14th Amendment, their city, because the 14th Amendment had not had the Second Amendment incorporated through it against the states, that the city of Chicago could have any sort of gun ban that they wanted. Essentially, this whole gun ban in Chicago, circa 1982, is completely race-based, where they said, blacks can't have guns. We don't want them to have guns. We don't want anybody to have guns. But because there's problems in different areas described mainly as low income, high density, and with a high propensity for public housing, assisted housing, you have a lot of crime. People don't have much in the way of jobs. They don't have much in the way of income. They don't have much in the way of really wanting to get out of that funk and work hard to get out of it. So it's just a perpetual cycle. And a lot of crime develops with that sort of mindset. So they didn't want to have any more guns around there. So basically what they're saying, we don't want blacks to have guns. We're passing this gun ban. And even now, in 2010, Chicago was arguing in favor for having a racist law. The gun ban in Chicago that came through in 1982 was race-based. And even in 2010, they are arguing that they should still be allowed to have a race-based law, because the 14th Amendment, which offered a lower form of citizenship to what were the newly freed black slaves of the day. And I'm not, guys, by no means do I want anybody to send me sort of an email that say, hey, you're talking about all your racist. No, I'm giving you an historical account. I'm telling you that Chicago was racist. The way that the 14th Amendment was written, the 14th Amendment was written to offer some form of citizenship, albeit not nearly to the level that the original class of citizenship had as outlined in the Constitution. The 14th Amendment citizenship gave civil rights and did not recognize inalienable rights, which is what the original class of citizenship has. So if you were black or of mixed race, you are a 14th Amendment class citizen. They still recognize that, folks. I want you to understand that the federal government, because of the 14th Amendment, does not give equal rights to blacks as they do from the original class of citizenship. So what they have done is, instead of saying, you know what, this whole 14th Amendment thing is really a bunch of garbage, we should pass a new amendment which essentially debunks the entire 14th Amendment and give the same inalienable class of citizenship to everyone in America. Rather than doing that, what they've tried to do is, through the process of paperwork, all the stuff you would ever sign at any government level anywhere, city, county, state, federal. The C in citizen, when they talk about a citizen of the United States, is lowercase. That is specifically the type of citizenship offered in the 14th Amendment. The original class of citizen is a capital C. You will never see a capital C in citizenship on any government form anywhere at any time. If you do, I would love for you to scan and email me that. Bill@2aradio.com. Send that to me, because that I want to see. From what I understand, there is nary a single form anywhere in any government level, from municipal to federal, where the word citizen is capitalized. It's all lowercase. Because again, rather than offering the 14th Amendment class of citizens the inalienable rights enjoyed by the original class of citizens, they have over many years done their best, through the paperwork process again, to put everyone under the 14th Amendment class of citizens, to where we don't have any inalienable rights. We have civil rights. Civil rights can be granted and removed through the legislative process and can be adjudicated on by the courts. Now, in this case, right here, McDonald v. Chicago, they have strengthened the 14th Amendment class of citizen. But still, it is up for judicial review and legislative process. You really want to see a referendum? Imagine this. Because Barack Obama is mulatto, he's half black, half white, he is a 14th Amendment class citizen. He does not enjoy any inalienable rights whatsoever because of the way the 14th Amendment was written, quite honestly, by the racists who wrote it after the Civil War. There you go. That's history for you. If you want to learn more about it, go to originalintent.org. You can read all about the original intent of the framers of the Constitution, and specifically on the 14th Amendment. You'll see exactly what I'm talking about. Now, continuing on with the McDonald v. Chicago adjudication here. The most explicit evidence of Congress's aim... A lot of more stuff cited here. I went on my tirade about the 14th Amendment. Most people don't seem to understand that the 14th Amendment does not offer the same level of citizenship as the original class. See, today it is generally accepted that the 14th Amendment was understood to provide a constitutional basis for protecting the rights set out in the Civil Rights Act of 1866. In debating the 14th Amendment, the 39th Congress referred to the right to keep and bear arms as a fundamental right deserving of protection. Senator Samuel Pomeroy described three indispensable safeguards of liberty under our form of government. One of these, he said, was the right to keep and bear arms. He said the following, quote, "Every man should have the right to bear arms for the defense of himself and family and his homestead. And if the cabin door of the freedman is broken open and the intruder enters for purposes of vile, as were known to slavery, then should a well-loaded musket be in the hands of the occupant to send the polluted wrench to another world, where his wretchedness will forever remain complete." Now, that's pretty powerful. Basically, if somebody busts into your door and you've been a freed black slave and you are now a free man, and some racist cracker busts in your door to do you or your family harm, blow them away. That's what he was saying in today's terms. Even those who thought the 14th Amendment unnecessary believe that blacks as citizens quote, have equal rights to protection and to keep and bear arms for self-defense. Evidence from the period immediately following the ratification of the 14th Amendment only confirms that the right to bear arms was considered fundamental. In an 1868 speech addressing the disarmament of freedmen, Representative Stevens emphasized the necessity to the right. Disarm a community and you rob them of the means of defending life. Take away their weapons of defense and you take away the inalienable right of defending liberty. The 14th Amendment, now so happily adopted, settles the whole question. Actually, all it did was raise more. And in debating the Civil Rights Act of 1871, Congress routinely referred to the right to keep and bear arms as described, described the continued disarmament of blacks in the South. Finally, legal commentators of the period emphasized the fundamental nature of the right. The right to keep and bear arms was also widely protected by the state's constitutions at the time when the 14th Amendment was ratified. Guys, I gotta tell you, this is just fantastic news. We won in Chicago. We won. I'm gonna sew all this up after the break. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes. You're listening right here on 2A Radio.
The American Dream, founded by men of honor, men of a creed once shared by most, and now all but forgotten. Men who risked their lives and perpetrated the most egregious acts of treason in history to create the United States of America. The Founding Fathers recognized that tyranny reigns over unarmed men, and they vowed to never allow that to happen here in the United States of America. Politicians of a lesser ilk have tried to subvert the right to self-protection, to protect your family and property. Until now, announcing America's Victory Shoots, the largest patriotic shooting event in generations, celebrating the Supreme Court's decision in McDonald versus Chicago, restoring the rights of all Americans across the land, from sea to shining sea, right in the backyard of Chicago itself. America's Victory Shoot is for Americans who share the creed of our founding fathers. Join your countrymen in a celebratory weekend of shooting events and training for the protection of you and your family at the patriotic event of a generation. There's limited space, so go to victoryshoot.org to find out more and sign up today.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back.
Back on!
Hi guys, welcome back. I got an email actually that came through the website from a guy by the name of Ash, and he says, look at page 67. And Justice Thomas, he says, a right is a privilege of American citizenship. What? Okay, here's the deal. I went to page 67. This is what he says. I agree with that description of the right, but I cannot agree with its enforceable against the states through a clause that speaks only to process. Instead, the right to keep and bear arms is a privilege of American citizenship that applies to the states through the 14th Amendment's Privileges or Immunities Clause. And legally speaking, he's absolutely right, because he wrote citizenship with a lowercase c. The 14th Amendment is a privileged class of citizenship. It is not inalienable, as I've been saying throughout the last segment, and I was talking about, I think it was last Friday we hit on this, a little bit last Wednesday and also last Friday. Citizenship with a lowercase c is a 14th Amendment class of citizenship. All right? That's it. That's all there is. Now, I have something to announce. We are not quite ready to finish up all of the last little tidbits on it, but I have, for today, we're going to get it done by the end of the day. I am announcing right now live on the air. What we're going to have is called America's Victory Shoot, celebrating McDonald v. Chicago. It's going to be August 21st and 22nd of 2010, this year. August 21st and 22nd, right in the backyard of Mayor Daley, right outside of Chicago in Waterman, Illinois, at the Aurora Sportsman's Club. We are going to have 500 attendees. We have sponsors. We have Gun Owners of America sponsoring the event. The Second Amendment March, Second Amendment Foundation. We have all kinds of sponsors that have come on board, or sponsors or supporters, in fact. Let me actually pull up the full list of all of the different people that are supporting America's Victory Shoot. That's the name of this. This is my baby. I'm putting this whole thing on. We've been working on it for months to put this whole thing together, waiting for today to announcement. Second Amendment March, Gun Owners of America, the Gun Owners Fellowship, JFPO, Oath Keepers, RBN, Second Amendment Foundation, U.S. Concealed Carry Association, and National Association for Gun Rights. Your buddy and mine, Dudley Brown, he's actually the very first to sign on. Tim Schmidt, U.S. Concealed Carry Association, was seeking us out. Skip Coriel of Second Amendment March. These are all the organizations that are supporting us, supporting me, and America's Victory Shoot. We have a website up called victoryshoot.org. We are not quite ready with being able to take orders just yet. So hold on until tomorrow or so. We have a couple of last-minute bugs to work out. The 11th hour turned into the 12th. We got a couple things to go. But guys, I am so excited about this. Ye have no idea. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you in Congress, the executive, and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Bill will be here tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The 2A Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.